Sorry about that.
Very good. Just all right?
That's terrific.
Just to begin with, to give you a scale of the budget, we're talking about approximately $2.5 billion to run the corrections department. Corrections really has two parts. It has the prison system, which is huge, and I'll discuss that in a bit, and then the probation system, which is even larger. The rough figures are 92,000 inmates in the prison system, 155,000 offenders on probation and parole. But most of that is probation, and we manage that. Now, the large costs, as you might imagine, are in the prison system. And I'll give you some details on that. One thing I want to point out is the size of the health budget for us. And this is completely absorbed by the way in the prison system. None of the health goes for the offenders in the field with some minor diversions for substance abuse treatment. But as you can see there, right now I'm running $365 million. I'll give you some projections. I'm giving you the official projections. I do not think they adequately take into account a couple of things. Number one, the aging population. Number two, the state of mental health in the prison system. And number three, the onslaught of AIDS and other very expensive to treat diseases like that. And I'll give you some of my views on that, but I will project for you what I think it's going to cost. As you also see up there, we have a fixed capital budget, which is a constant investment for us. We have to build one or two prisons every year to keep up with the pace of the growing number of inmates. And a rough figure for a prison, and you'll get more detail on this, is about $100 million a pop. And this gives you, I know they're very fine, but I tried to project out for you. This is the official projections of the populations. We're currently at 93,000 approximately today, and I expect to be close to 97,000 in a year. And then if you take it out to the year 2013, August of 2013, unless we do something different, and I am going to be talking to you about doing things different, it'll be up to 114,000. Now, having given you this projection of population, has been my experience in the past 18 months, which is my tenure in the department, that every time we have projected, we have surpassed the projection several months in advance. So I am roughly 1,000 ahead right now where I was projected to be at this time. That, of course, has budgetary impact and, of course, great impact on the public safety of the state. Now, you see on the cost projections, if you notice that really middle column, when we lay out the operating budget, here's where I think we have some inaccuracies. Currently, my operating budget is $2.27 billion. I'm saying in 2014, with about almost 21,000 more inmates, it's going to be roughly the same. I really don't see that. It's going to be far in advance of that. As an aside here, I'll tell you, mental health, we are probably the major provider of mental health in the state of Florida, with the possible exception of the Department of Children and Families. Yes, sir.
Jim, excuse me. You've given us cost projections. These are yours, but then you say these aren't reliable?
That's what I'm saying. I have no faith. To be clear, I have no faith that we're going to increase our operating expenses by $100 million over the next 7 years. I think it's going to be more than that.
All right. But these are numbers that you and your folks have crunched out.
Me and my folks and other bodies that officially review the projection of costs.
Okay, but these are your costs. These aren't political tinkering by anybody.
No, they're not. These are honest people sitting, not that anybody else would not be honest, but these are honest people giving the facts, trying to do their best assessments of what future costs would be.
And nonetheless, you're telling us we're probably going to surpass them.
That's what I'm telling you. We're going to surpass. I can see this from such things as the aging of the population, the mental health alone. Mental health, I really need to stress that. It is so central to the difficulties we have in the state in regard to public safety and so manifest in my system. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about, the largest single sector, growing sector of my population is women, and women are running a 50% mental illness rate in my system, 50%. For the men, it's running 13%. And as we get more women, we get therefore higher percentages throughout the whole system and much greater cost if we're going to deal with that. Much of that is dealt with psychotropic drugs. Yes, ma'am.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Martha.
What do you attribute the fact that women are the largest growing cohort in the prison population? I know that about a decade, less than a decade ago, I realized that young girls were one of the largest growing populations in the juvenile justice system, but is it a reflection of that or something else?
I think it's that, for sure. I mean, the one leads to the other. It's also, I think, an unfortunate change in our culture where women now compete with the men on all things, to include the bad things. Probably steeped in substance abuse, but it's also steeped, I'm giving you very amateur views, because I have reflected on this, a very loose culture where family values have been weakened, and the sort of protective enclaves we had around young women have therefore been weakened, and they fall prey to their own mistakes, but also the exploitation of others. But it's a very sad case to say. I was in a women's prison just last Friday, and I was noted that the HIV rate was 6.8% in that prison alone. And the construction of prisons, it's, as you, ladies and gentlemen, know, given your sophistication, there is an attractiveness to that, to some of the areas in which these prisons are built. They bring in jobs. They are, in fact, in many of the rural counties, the major employment. But it is a $100 million pop, and it does continue at a constant rate. So let me give you my first big view, which I hope will engender the discussion. There are two things that feed the growth in population in prisons. One is a given that a certain percent of our population will make mistakes, do bad things, have evil intentions, and therefore we'll get picked up by our system and enter into a prison system. That's the one large thing. The other thing is the flow of those that will return to the system. And right now we're running a 32% return rate within 3 years. The recidivism rate, I would define it in this way, is extraordinarily high. It goes up beyond 3 years, but in 3 years it's 32%. So if you would envision this as two streams, the expanding population leads therefore to a major stream of new inmates coming into the system, and then you have a circular stream that comes out of the system and comes right back in. It's a thinner stream, but it is a significant stream. How significant? Every month now I let out 3,000 inmates, every month. So that means at the end of the year, 36,000 inmates will come out. Well, I'm telling you that within 3 years, one-third of them will come back. So if you take one-third of that 12,000, that means in 3 years, I've got to have room for 4,000. That's two prisons for $200 million, then the operating expenses over that. Now, I do not believe you can constrain that larger stream, which is that certain percent of the population that will do criminal things. But I do believe you can constrict that smaller stream, that returning population, which I do not believe has to be at 32%. And I have set an internal goal to bring that down to 20% or less, and I have revised the mission of the department to add a concern for reentry. Not only is my mission the near-term public safety of supervising probationers and containing prisoners, but to prepare prisoners when they return to society to be better citizens. And that has a cost to it, but I'm going to argue that the return on that cost is at least 5-1, and I would argue that 8-1. So I throw in here, for example, the very last item. I'm giving you the sort of tally of the cost to run a prison. And if you'll note, it costs me about $52 a day to keep a person incarcerated. That equates to roughly $20,000 a year. But for $1.26 more a day with some substance abuse treatment, I can get a significant reduction in the that recidivism. And let me make this point very clear. I never argue publicly or privately that to make such investments we do for the interest of the inmate. I put that third. The first reason I argue for it is for public safety. If we can get them out of prison better prepared to be citizens, they do not commit crime at the rate they do. The second reason I argue for it is very germane to what you're doing, and that is cost. You see, if I can cut it from 32% to 20%, and if you do the math on that, I'm saving us a prison plus a year, or $100 million plus operating expenses a year. Operating expenses, by the way, for a prison in a year go about $40 million. So if you do the total cost, the building of the prison, the operating of the prison, it's $140 million. Now, my major goal is public safety. So when I supervise an offender on the streets, public safety is the primary issue. And when I retain an inmate in prison, public safety. But included in that is preparing that prisoner, that inmate, to return to society. By the way, my formula on that 20% is not an arbitrary figure. There is some math I put behind it. There are four things that I rank as important to making that succeed. Number one is education, the ability to read. Most importantly, to give an idea of where we are, I've got an average education level of sixth grade amongst the inmates. To give an idea how extreme it gets, I have 4,000 inmates at first and second grade level. So for each year, I can raise the reading, and with that, their math a little bit. The data show that I can lower the recidivism by 3 to 4 to 5%. Substance abuse, actually second, I would say, would be vocational training. And I am very underfunded for vocational training, but I'm enlisting as many volunteer efforts as I can. And that's to ensure they get a job. So the reading and the vocational training will hopefully get them a job and give them incentive not to commit crime. Third thing, huge, is substance abuse treatment. And the data there are very solid. If we can get the addict for treatment, we lower the probability of recidivating by about 35 to 40%. And the final thing I rank is, which I don't believe bears many costs, it's giving them the accoutrements, the management skills to manage their own life. The accoutrements would be things like a driver's license, a social security card, some means of identification, and then, of course, some basic instruction on how to manage a budget, how to shop for a week as opposed to a day, how to work a bank properly. And I think we can lower it. Now, of course, there are some that are incorrigible, and I take that into account. I understand, I think, the scope of human nature, but I do believe most of them, given an opportunity to make it, will take the right course of action. So that's an important point for me to make, because when I went through the budget cutting, the first suggestion implied to me, at least implied by some, was why don't you look at cutting the unnecessary factors of public safety, such as education, vocational training, substance abuse treatment, which would have been a package of about $50 million. But I argue, no, those are the very things I need to retain for public safety. And I'll show you some other ways to approach it. Now, what is a 10% cut for me? A 10% cut for me is enormous. It's $220 million. And I would like to show you how I approach that. But let me ask at this point if you have any questions on this quick overview of the projection of our budget. Let me proceed. I'm sure we'll see some opportunities here to ask some questions.
Are your funds primarily general revenue funds?
They are. But there's a significant portion, $200 million or so a year, goes into fixed capital outlay. Now, I did one invention with my budget cutting task. The guidance was to consider only recurring funds. So general revenue is recurring. Capital outlay is not considered recurring. And when the guidance came, it said consider only recurring funds with a capital R. I took the capital and made it smaller case. Because you see, for me, capital outlay recurs every year. And if I was to get at the big money, $220 million, I could only do that by not building prisons. So the real question was, how do you not build prisons and maintain the public safety? That was the parameters. Now, it was an invention, I thought it was an ethical invention, only do ethical things. And I will now try to make the case how we can save that money. And Mr. Chair.
Right.
My mission, to protect the public, essentially. That's our mission. In that, by the way, I approach that three ways. Protect the public, protect the people that work in the department, protect the people that are supervised by my department. And those three are quite critical, and you have to consider each of them. There's no two ways about it. Prisons are dangerous places. How many institutions do we run with inmates in them? 59 if you count just the major prisons. But if you do over work camp, work release centers, we get up to about 128. They spread all over the map of Florida, the preponderance of rural areas. Therefore, major political impact, major job security in rural areas. And this is just to preface how much we're trying to do. Right now, even without a cut, I'm facing a deficit of about $26 million. Much of this is steeped in health costs. I have an obligation under the law, and I have a moral obligation to provide adequate health care to the inmates. My inmates are an extremely unhealthy bunch, terrible lifestyles for the most part, and they come in with manifest problems, and it's our obligation to work through them. Suicide, for example, mental health issue related to depression is a major threat in the prison system, so we have to watch that all the time. But there are just there's no end to the costs that we incur. Anyway, I'm just making the case. I'm on a tight budget now and wondering how I'm going to make ends meet. So the 10% is quite a chore, but we can do it. These are the principles we laid out as we went through it. Foremost, public safety. And then we went through sort of a cost risk factor, and I'm talking about letting some inmates outside of prison walls earlier than expected, but not in violation of 85% rules, and we sort of rank ordered where we would take that risk. So we've only considered those we deem least risk. And then, of course, state in compliance with Florida statute.
How do you do that, Jim?
How do you do that?
Yeah, how do you select those without violating the 85%?
I'd like to show you.
Okay.
I have three ways. The first three are three ways I can do that. The fourth actually would cause us to go below the 85% rule for three single intervals of time, and I'll explain that. And I do not really propose the fourth one, which is a control release. It's the first three I think are doable. So I call them supervised reentry. What that does, let me give you the big picture. I'll put the slides up. But if you can just conceptualize this. Currently, I have a number of inmates who are coming towards the end of their time. They're low risk, and they're out in society. Here in Orlando, if you went to eat tonight on Universal or Drive, there's a good chance that your waiter or your cook or your busboy is actually an inmate, an offender. Not someone on probation, but an inmate. I have several work release centers right here in this immediate area, and I'm not kidding, actually work downtown. I know that. I've sort of tracked them and gone to eat where they work. They come right up and serve your family. Who are these people? These are low-risk people who are about to get out into society, and they live in a work release center. Usually that number is about 80 or 90, sometimes 120 people. And during the day, they go out to work, and they go out on their own. We don't take them there. They get up, they eat their breakfast, they do their chores, and they go out. Think of it as a sort of a workers' camp. In the evening, they come home, and we feed them, and they go to bed. They live behind a chain-link fence, but it is not locked. Nor is there any barbed wire. Nor are there any officers that keep them from going out. For the most part, they do not do anything wrong because they're about to get out. And they have a job. By the way, we garner their funds. We control their funds. If they misbehave in any way, and we drug test them often, and we supervise them closely, any misbehaviors, they return to prison and will spend the rest of the time in a regular prison, and then when their sentence is up, they go out. I have 3,000 plus of these, and I have another equal amount on a waiting list to go into these. Now, the other thing that we do with these inmates, if you can picture this, since we're trying to get them prepared to return to society, they're allowed to have a sponsor. And the sponsor can check them out for a weekend when they're not working. So we do a background check on their sponsor. They show up, they pick up the inmate, they go home with the inmate. At the end of the day, they must come back and spend the night in the work release center. By the way, we've had virtually no problems with this group over the years. This is not a one-time thing. Here's the idea. Take this group currently in the work release centers and extend their furlough with their sponsor overnight. Supervise them just the same. In fact, increase the supervision. We would continue to garner their funds. We could continue to control their banking. We would continue to drug test them. In fact, we would upgrade their drug testing. We even have as a proposal here to link them up with a reentry drug court, which would take a statute. And I've been talking with some of the members of the bench, particularly people like Judge Melanie May, Judge Marsha Beach, on how we might do this. And the idea would be to increase the supervisory constraints while releasing them for the period of time that otherwise would sleep in the work camp. And then take the 3,000 plus on the waiting list and move them into the work release center. They would abide by current rules there. They would, in fact, return for the night, and then in time we would switch them out. Now, what this does, if you just freeze frame the short flow there, you see I suddenly release 3,000 inmates from behind prison walls, freeze up 3,000 beds, and I don't go to prison. And I don't run the operating cost of that other prison. I can do that immediately. I could do, if given the execute on that, I could make that happen in 60 to 75 days, and I believe safely. And I've put some money up there on what it would save us this year and how much it would save us next year. And proposal one comes pretty close to hitting that 10% goal. But I will add at this point that you can combine some of these proposals to hit whatever number you want to hit. I actually think this is very advantageous. I actually think it would be in the interest of the state to do this. I do not believe it would impact public safety. I would say it would heighten public safety. You would have more constraints currently on those in work release centers, more opportunities to supervise them and provide them treatment, by the way. And we would be preparing well in advance yet another group. One of my problems with the work release centers, I don't have enough time to develop the offender for full freedom. This would give me more time to do just that. Any infractions, back inside. So the incentive not to misbehave would be extremely high. I think it would work. Let me jump to proposal two, because there's ways you can combine proposals one and two. This may have come up in your earlier discussions. I receive a lot of year-and-a-day sentences. Why does that happen? Quite frankly, because it's a convenient way to pass costs from municipalities and counties to the state. If the inmate is convicted for year-and-a-day, he comes to me. He does not go to the jail. If it's a year or less, he goes to jail. So as localities come under pressure, increasingly judges have been assigning year-and-a-day. About 4% of my population now is year and a day. Now, I actually don't get them for year and a day because they're sitting in jail waiting trial. They go to court. There's administrative things that happen. It takes a while for me to in-process them. Generally, when I get them, we have 5 or 6 months. Technically, they do not calculate out to qualify for state imprisonment. But I get them anyway. But they have to go someplace. It's feasible, I believe, to put them into locations where they're not in prison, but are supervised by the state, again, with all of the constraints I talked about, halfway houses, substance abuse treatment centers, things of this nature, combine them with a faith-based option for reintegration reasons, and I think we can manage them very well to save us some spaces in prisons while keeping the public safe. I believe that they come to us, many of them, in fact most of them, strictly for the convenience of not costing the locality the money. I don't fault the locality for that, but the net effect on the state, I don't believe there's been an increase in public safety. It's just been a displacement of who pays the bill for incarceration. This one you see, again, would save us about another prison plus and save me some operating and capital expenses, and over the 2 years piles up. Now, if you combine the work release center option and this option, you're starting to talk some money. We can, in fact, you combine them in different ways, we can get that above 10% or above $220 million. And we can do that repeatedly, particularly this option, for indefinite number of years. So there are some ways in which to play this out. Now, let me mention the downside, which will surely happen. If one of these inmates commits a heinous crime, just one, it will be great alarm and will be used as a cudgel to condemn us for our poor judgment in making a decision such as this. All I can say is the reality we deal with every day. On the probation side, I was these people not incarcerated. On the probation, I've had 57 probationers this year under my supervision, I'm sorry to say, commit murder. 57. Which is going to be on track for a record year. Total last year was 59. Just by that's another problem. My observation is crime is increasing, and violent crime increasing even more in recent years. I'm sure that's what you were pointing out with your briefing. But that will be a sure detriment to this approach. But that aside, I'm telling you it's my opinion that we can maintain the public safety where we have it now and perhaps increase it, particularly in option one, with lower costs. Let me just quickly run through option three and four, and then I'll be done. I draw out the advantages here. I have laid out the major disadvantage. For proposal three, to be clear, also keeps us at 85% or up. This is an internal move by me. I am authorized to grant gain time down to 85% of sentence on current law. Gain time is an incentive for an inmate to behave well. They essentially come in with their gain time, but as they misbehave, and there are many ways you can misbehave in prison, we take away some of their time. So you don't get into the chow line the right way, and you can be admonished, and you can lose some gain time. You don't clean your bunk area the way you're supposed to, you can lose gain time. Talk back to a guard or an officer, you lose gain time, and so on. So as it turns out, in the normal course of a sentence, most inmates lose gain time, which means they serve something more than 85%. Now, I've gone through the numbers, and what I could do is return gain time. I could give gain time grants. All right, you are forgiven for your loss of gain time. Your gain time is returned, and the net effect would, if I did that once this fiscal year in the fall, once this fiscal year in the spring, and one more time in the fall, you start piling your money up. Once again, I can come very close all by itself with this 10% cut. Now, having said that, I can do that with inmates that are going to get out anyway. What the math would look like is instead of getting out, for example, 17 months from now, then you may get out 16 months from now. Or instead of getting out 9 months from now, they may get out 8 months from now. So it is minor returns on gain time. It does relieve pressure on the population. Suddenly, you'd see an infusion of departures, which would save us building a prison and or more, and save us the operating costs. Now, here's the downside of this one. I have to be very careful how I throw incentives and disincentives around in my system. If I'm cavalier about that, you suddenly have no incentives to behave. So a calculating inmate, evil intent, could say, I'll do anything I want, and they'll sock me with game time, but I know they're going to give me a pardon at the end of it. And then I've got internal problems. Now, I think I can control that. I'm very stable, despite all of the historic problems of the department. I will tell you, I have a very stable system inside those prison walls. Very well run, very organized. So I'm not afraid of an uprising. Not at all. But I do need to maintain order. Remember, one of my public safety missions, actually two of my public safety missions are inside those walls, the officers that work there and the inmates themselves. So I do need to maintain order.
Jim?
Yes, sir.
But what criteria will you use to issue those periodic amnesty? Because essentially what you're talking about is issuing an amnesty.
That's correct.
Three times a year.
One time. One time, three times.
One time.
Three times in 1 year.
How do you do it? What
criteria? Well, we would look at that. We rank order the degree of infraction. Not everyone would get an amnesty. That's the correct word. So in other words, those that really misbehaved, brutalized another inmate, attacked an officer, not going to happen. But those minor infractions, we could sort of rank order them and say, okay, this group, this group, this group. And you start to, the cuts, in fact, end up in the thousands.
And if you do that, and somebody knows that by stepping out of line, the chow line, in the future, that will be forgiven, how do you maintain that discipline?
That's the exact risk I was mentioning. I have to be fairly subtle. There can be no guarantees that this is coming. It'd be sort of a card I would hold close to the chest. So suddenly we would declare an amnesty, and then a few months later suddenly we would declare another amnesty. I don't think I'd call it an amnesty. That's what it is.
Now, these three proposals, have any of them been approved yet?
No, none at all. I'm sharing with you what I submitted to the governor a few weeks ago. It was due on August 8th. The legislature got a copy at the same time. They'll have to weigh these options, and they have to decide, the collective, both the legislative and the executive branch.
Do any of these require statutes?
Yes. In my opinion, there will be statutory modifications. The three I've mentioned are relatively minor. The one would be major reentry drug court. We have no stipulation now in law for a reentry drug court. But during special session, I think that's, if adopted, it's feasible to work these things through the special session.
Now, assuming you get these adopted and they work, suppose they work, are you saying that this could be a model for cutting down costs in the future?
Here's my point, and that's the exact question. Let me disregard proposal 4, which takes us below 85%.
Go ahead and do it if you want to finish.
So I'll just tell you what it is. In this case, I don't do anything. I allow the prisons to crowd. And I allow legal precedent to dictate an automatic release from prison. There is much case law that tells me what I'm provided, what I must provide in law, and it also says when I hit a certain point, I have no recourse but to let them out. This means I stop building, and it means we get overcrowded. Essentially, when I get to 97% now of my capacity, I'm constrained. This allows me in increments to start letting people out. If nobody did anything, you see, if the budget shrunk, if there was no statute passed, no changes in policy forthcoming, I would have to do Proposal 4 by law. It is not, in my opinion, safe because it would dictate some of the wrong people getting out at the wrong time. But it is something that could happen, hence it's listed.
I don't think you're going to get that one approved.
I know not, but so my point is this. If we do nothing, it's a default option. Law would dictate. But we have to do something.
And the people who, if that happened, the people who would be released under this program, would not be the people you'd pick and choose, they'd be based on time served?
I would try to pick and choose, but I would have less control, be more time served. Yes, ma'am. Now, where I had options to use a solid rationale for public safety, I would. But this gives us the least control on public safety. It's a dicey option. Let me give you my big picture on this, because it gets at your question, Mr. Chair. I don't enter this profession as a career professional in it, so I'm limited in that regard. But nor do I enter it as of any particular ideological bent. If anything, by nature, I'm more conservative than not. And I have seen my share of hard times and feel I have a good feel for human nature. And although I like to trust people, I always keep a beady eye on everything. So I'm telling you, I'm not a soft sell. But I do believe that over the years, we have gone to one extreme in the criminal justice system, and that is hard laws, hard time. You decrease crime by taking people off the street and keeping them off as long as you can. The reality is that 90% plus of the inmates in my system will return to the street. And unless we prepare them for that, the probability of recommitting offenses is extremely high. When I say 32% over 3 years, here's the way I think about it, and it's the way I used to think about it when I was responsible for the counter-drug effort in the state. For every felony we catch them and convict them on, they've committed many more, probably 20 or so. I used to use a rough rule of thumb of 20. If you start using the numbers I'm talking about, 3,000 a year, or 3,000 a month, or 36,000 a year, times the recidivism rate, times the number of crimes they've committed, unless we take steps to prepare them, we are subjecting ourselves to a lot of crime we don't have to. The investments in the four things I mentioned, education, vocational training, substance abuse treatment, and life management skills, although they take money, I think are a minor investment. They begin to bring the pendulum back. They will, in fact, first of all, decrease crime in the state of Florida. Secondly, they will decrease our expenses. Thirdly, they'll be better for those individuals that are prepared to take advantage of them.
You know, Jim, if I can suggest something, because I know your intentions, you're a good guy with the right intentions. I would not necessarily market this idea the way you did it, because you're basically saying the pendulum has swung too much in treating prisoners harshly. I wouldn't even go there, because you're suggesting let's kind of swing back to treat them more kindly. I think that you're basically saying that let's do a better job of reintegrating them back into the community, be more proactive. And that will have, not treat them less harshly, treat them harshly, but once we get them ready to go back into the community, let's provide for an approach that is more effective.
All right, I'll take your
advice. I think that's what you're getting at.
That is.
Okay.
I hear you saying none of what you're doing is for the benefit of the inmate. It's for the benefit of people of Florida.
No, I ranked order them. I do believe I have obligations to do as much as I can for the inmate.
But you said public safety was your first concern.
First concern.
That's the public is on the outside.
That's correct. But they will come back to the outside. And if they're less inclined to commit crime, once they come back, the public is more safe. Yes.
How do you see, and I'm sure there are studies on this, but how do you see the minimum mandatories, three strikes you're out, some of that impacting prison populations and the programs you're talking about here?
Well, the other one would be the anti-murder bill. Let me take the last one first. We really expected a great influx under the anti-murder bill. We have not seen it. And I've been tracking the data for the several months it's been out, and I reviewed the data, I think, about a week and a half ago. So far, we have not seen a great influx of prisoners because of the anti-murder bill. The other things did, in fact, bring in a lot of inmates. Anticipated, worked into the estimates. I actually think, since you asked me my opinion, some of that has been good for society. We had a run here of 30 years where the crime rate went down. But I believe it's turning. I think that 1 year does not make a trend, or 2 years does not make a trend. But my instincts tell me it's turning. Certainly my population is rising beyond estimates. And as I take a look at the population I have, I don't think that all of those necessarily have to be lifelong criminals, that we can, in fact, work with them. I didn't mention faith-based. I should have mentioned faith-based. We have three prisons that are fully faith-based, another three partially. The only thing I don't have yet with faith-based prisons is solid data to project a likely lower probability of recidivism. I think it will happen. I just don't have any scientific database on that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Jay? Secretary, you said something very intriguing about this recidivism thing. I don't want to lose it, and if you can help quantify it, I think it's a very powerful thing to talk about. Recidivism is defined as someone who has left our system and come back.
That's the way I did it. There's many ways to define it.
Well, I'll accept your definition, because I know far less about this than you do. So, but then you said, during that time, between the time we catch them and prosecute them the second time, crime is being committed. And I know it would be very impossible to quantify that, but it strikes me that it's even more compelling in your argument of how to get them better prepared not to come back. If you use the word 20 times, that there might be 20 additional crimes committed before we actually catch them and prosecute them again and bring them back into the system, that's staggering.
Yes.
Using your math, I mean, the 36,000, yeah. 35%, 10 times 20, it's not on the FCAP, but I can take it and pass it. I think that is that's a cost that is out there. That's the cost of that police department that was here before. They're investigating those crimes, but they're not, in effect, catching the person who's doing them for a number of times until you finally get them.
You can make the argument both ways. You can say, well, look, all that crime being committed, does this argue for more law and order, keep them in longer, put more cops on the street? I will tell you this, just one of the four areas I talked about, drugs. I used to be the guy in charge of the counter-drug effort for the state, and I got an education in addiction. You may think that the problem is drugs flowing in my system. I do have drugs flowing in my system. I catch them every day, but that's not the problem. Most inmates don't get any drugs while they're in the system. But here's what I can tell you. Although only 25% are in there for a drug-related conviction, and I think deservedly so, by the way. I'm not talking about the casual marijuana user. I'm talking about dealing in drugs.